Danielle DiMartino Booth, CEO and Chief Strategist for QI Research. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
And thank you for having me again. It's good to see you, Tom.
Good to see you too, Danielle. You know, you always give us great updates and insight in the Fed. And I saw yesterday Trump tweeted a picture of throwing Powell into a dumpster with the caption, "Too late, Powell." So what is the current state of affairs with Powell in some capacity not leaving the Fed? And what nuances are there to understand here?
So I think there's two really different, there are two parallel narratives going on right now to Powell not leaving. First of all, Powell is, he's an attorney first and foremost. He's a lawyer, always has been. And the criminal charges kind of crossed a really dark red line. And I don't blame him until he is 150% exonerated and it's in writing that we can never come after you again after you leave office. I don't blame him for staying, just for the sake of his own personal integrity and peace of mind. I mean, who wants to go into retirement thinking to yourself, gee, well, the cops could knock on the front door any second now. I mean, so on a practical level, it's great that he's doing that. When you describe to me the actions taken by President Trump, too late, Powell, throwing him in a dumpster, that gets us to the much more nuanced, secondary, parallel narrative that I think is even more critical. And that is, if Trump continues to trash the Fed, then Jay Powell is going to feel increasingly compelled to stay to protect his seat, such that he's sure that it cannot be filled by somebody who Trump would not want to throw into a dumpster on social media. So I think the greater risk is, I mean, you know, once the criminal charges were dropped, they should have been completely dropped. And then maybe Powell would have walked out the door. But the fact that they weren't, and that they left a door open, and that Trump continues to berate him publicly, it just increases the odds, ironically, because Trump wants him out the door. But everything he does against him and every future insult that's hurled will make it more and more likely that Powell just stays on as governor until January of 2028.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the nuance to understand there is he's obviously done as Fed chair, but staying on the board of governors, right?
Exactly as was the case in 1948, when President Truman wanted to show Mariner Eccles the door. And instead, Eccles stayed, finished out his term. So obviously there's very little precedent for this, but in doing so prevented the Treasury from basically taking over the Fed and taking over Fed policy, which is why Eccles stayed. And he ensured that there was a hard line of separation between the Treasury and making monetary policy in the post-World War II era. And he did such he fulfilled a patriotic duty for his country in doing so, and it earned him his name on the building. So, you know, big shoes to fill, but at the same time, the same existential threat exists if Trump was to be able to succeed in quote unquote packing the Fed, where there was a majority of his appointees. Just Powell's presence alone prevents that from happening. And, you know, I've gotten more hate mail the last few days, which never fazes me. I believe that the Fed needs to be re-engineered. I wrote a whole book about it. I think that some of the ideas that Kevin Warsh has would be more than welcome, like telling all the Fed officials to shut the heck up, for there to be less communication, maybe to throw out the dot plot. By the way, these are all things that Powell advocated for when he was first Fed chair. He didn't like a big Fed balance sheet either. He doesn't like the dot plot. But we didn't know that much about Jay Powell until he was chair, because he was the quietest governor in the history of the Fed. He had no interest in the media. He made about between 20 and 25 major speeches. while he was governor, he was extremely behind the scenes. And in his press conference, he was very vocal about being deferential to the incoming leader, such that Warsh can build a consensus. So I don't think that Powell is staying there, as a lot of these conspiracy theorists are saying, to present a threat or to try and act as the shadow Fed chair. I think he's going to respect Warsh, the leader of the Fed, which is somewhat ironic given he had a triple dissent from people who wanted the easing language taken out of the statement when they were just really making a political statement, right? We were expecting the one dissent for a rate cut, but they actually showed the opposite. They showed that Powell should stay, because if they're going to try and create a coalition against Warsh and Powell's just going to go by the data and be a deferential, quiet governor in the background, then he can act as a line of defense.
Right. Well, and that's something that is kind of interesting, is their kind of growing dissent within the Fed and how they vote based on the, or around the decisions that are being made at the FOMCs.
Mm-hmm. There is, but again, my favorite Fed governor is Christopher Waller, because he's kind of just a straight down the middle guy. He follows the data. He pays attention to the fact that payrolls in the second quarter of 2025. And then on the day the Fed meets, last Wednesday, they got out payroll revisions for the third quarter of 2025 that showed a second consecutive quarter of net job losses every single month in the middle of 2025. And that's the day you say you should remove the easing bias language from the statement. So Waller and Powell are pretty good friends. And I think that Powell's going to be relieved to be able to go back to being data agnostic. So if Warsh wants to lead the Fed in a direction of looking for alternative data sources, maybe for saying, well, what's behind those continuing claims that seem like they've plateaued but are flat as a pancake, but oh, wait, actually only one in four Americans who are unemployed are collecting unemployment benefits. Let's look through the data and see what the real story is. And when we do, and we conclude that we're failing on our employment mandate, do something about it. I think that that kind of logic and simplistic logic that Christopher Waller enjoys and that Powell used to before he became a political, you know, kicking boy, I think Powell's going to enjoy going back to that role and actually could end up being an advocate for Kevin Warsh. And these are not things people are talking about. Mm-hmm.
If you could give one piece of advice to Warsh directly, what would it be?
It would be to watch out for that liquidity crisis. Because once he gets punched in the mouth, which is exactly what happened to Powell. Powell was very anti-quantitative easing. Powell was very anti-zero bound. He wanted to go in a completely opposite direction. And yet, when there was a liquidity crisis in 2018, going into 2019, he was backed into a corner because it looked like systemic risk was going to come unglued. So my advice to Kevin Warsh would be to try and figure out on day one how to handle a liquidity crisis if it comes about again. Is it absolutely necessary to immediately go to the zero bound and immediately relaunch quantitative easing? Or is there a third pathway, even if it involves a deeper recession, to get the Fed off of this kind of permanent lifeline of when the peanut butter hits the fan, we must take interest rates to zero and launch huge QE? I'm hoping that Warsh can find a third pathway around that.
Well, Danielle, do you think that the Fed's ability to maintain that liquidity and, let's say, that precision of injecting liquidity to avoid a major market correction has really improved over time here? You know, the last real moment of pain that was certainly warded off by going to that zero bound and printing was the 2020 crash. So is it, you know, are we still worried about a very dramatic correction still?
Well, given, you know, just last week, we went from talking quietly, right? We talk really loudly about the Strait of Hormuz, but we still talk quietly about private credit. So last week, we privately discussed the fact that a real estate private credit type firm had gated redemptions. And that's what we're starting to see. We're starting to see evidence of contagion beyond just kind of the, oh, it's Ares, it's KKR, it's Carlyle, it's Blackstone, it's Blue Owl. Is it Blue Owl? Anyways, it's some owl, but which is now practically a penny stock. But the discussion has moved on from, oh, there's other parts in the private market that are also now gating redemptions. And that's in commercial real estate. So is the discussion going to segue to, does this mean that banks with credit card rates at credit card delinquency rates, auto delinquency rates, you mention it, with these delinquency rates at the highest level since the great financial crisis, does this mean that we should be really having a discussion about tightening credit standards? That's the question. Mm-hmm. And if that's the question, that does become problematic for Kevin Warsh.
Well, I mean, it's, you and I talked about the crash of the commercial real estate bubble or what that could have caused. And it seems like, you know,
I hate to interrupt, but it hasn't. We have not seen the fallout. It wasn't until 2025 that we saw distressed office sales at the highest level in 10 years. We're just now beginning to see the true fallout in commercial real estate. And last week, we had a commercial real estate private entity gate redemptions telling you that the fall, that the declines in commercial real estate prices are just beginning. So it's they've had a heck of a lot of time to extend and pretend, but why don't we have a persistent oil shock push up interest rates to the extent that all the peanut butter starts to hit the fan? Because the last thing commercial real estate needed with distressed sales at a decade high was for interest rates to rise. And yet here we are.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to bring in the idea of household debt, you know, we're $18 trillion and rising, rising delinquencies in autos and credit cards, labor market softening. What's your base case for consumer spending and recession risk through the rest of this year here?
So right now, it was unfortunate because the one big beautiful bill was supposed to produce $1,000 extra for every American in their income tax refund. And it was all going to be daisies and roses and bumblebees and rainbows. In the end, it produced a $333 boost that was mostly consumed by higher oil prices. So that leaves the consumer in 2026 in a different position than the consumer was in 2025. As in more stretched. And Congress, you may or may not have noticed in the United States, is completely dysfunctional and does absolutely nothing. So prior to the midterms, going into the midterms, what are the odds that we're going to see some big stimulus check pass through this Congress? Pretty low. So because the income tax refund season wasn't what it needed to be for the U.S. household, because we're being told that the average car payment on a financed car has now hit a record $773, and that 20% of Americans' car payments are $1,000 or more. Mm-hmm. And job losses continue, and companies have just been hit by yet another margin squeeze, which means that they're only going to control what they can control, which is the only cost they can control, which is jobs. So we're in a very bad place going into these midterms for the U.S.
Well, and to add to that, you know, there's an indicator that every time the oil price surges around 50% above trend, it was a perfect predictor, 6 for 6, of the last 6 recessions here. Mm-hmm. So we just triggered that threshold again. Is that, you know, obviously oil feeds into every cost within the economy and fertilizer and food and everything. So it seems like this is a perfect recessionary storm here.
It is, except for the fact that all it's going to do is deepen the recession. Remember what I mentioned, that we now know that we don't have the fourth quarter of 2025 revisions in hand as of yet, but we now know that we had two back-to-back quarters in 2025 of net job losses in every single month, which means that we were in recession coming into this oil shock, which means that this will simply deepen it and cause yet another wave of layoffs. That's where we really are. I know we're not supposed to, I know it's your job to talk about whether recession is coming, but it's my job to explain that recession's actually already here. And that's what these revisions that nobody talks about, that's what these revisions have told us. I mean, net job losses for 6 months in a row never happened in US history without being in recession. And it's in the rearview mirror. And it looked like the momentum.
Well, I was going to say, it depends on, I guess, how you define that recession, right?
Well, GDP is the last thing to get revised. So that's coming. Now that we know that there were hundreds of thousands of fewer workers in the workforce in 2025, now the Bureau of Economic Analysis has to back all of that imputed income out of GDP consumption. Mm-hmm. Because now they know, oh, a hell of a lot fewer people were working than we thought. Now we're going to have to go backwards and downwardly revise GDP. But of course, we're talking about bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. This is going to take a while. But no, there is nothing that is more definitive in defining recession than net job destruction that persists. And that's exactly where we are. You mentioned the oil shock and crossing a critical threshold. What you didn't mention was that many of these oil shocks were temporary in nature. This one seems to be persisting.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Danielle. And, you know, how do you, as a, in some ways, a data researcher, how do you try to understand these data trends right now? You know, it seems like already coming into the oil shock, the Iran conflict, we had a lot of issues around job losses related to AI. Mm-hmm. So this was already an accelerating trend, never mind companies that are maybe trying to get ahead of the oil shock. Like, let's say, for example, I know you posted recently, Meta cutting enough employees that it exactly adds up to $10 billion worth of revenue that they need to account for. So, I mean, is there a way to kind of separate this, the causes of all of these job losses out, or does it even really matter?
At this point, I don't think it matters at this point, because we've established momentum to the downside. And I think a lot of what's happening with, I look at job losses in the current cycle as having come in two major waves. One was correcting for the overhiring that followed the pandemic. So you just had to get your workforce down to the right size to meet a world in which demand is not being constantly stimulated by fiscal stimulus checks going out in the mail. But we're past the right sizing, which means that now we're going to start to cut into the corpus. And now we're going to start to push through layoffs that take workforces below where they were prior to the pandemic. And in fact, the Atlanta Fed wage inflation tracker tells us that wage growth has now gone all the way back, round-tripped, fully reversed the gains that we saw in the post-pandemic era. Wage growth is back to where it was in 2019. That's where we are right now going into this oil shock.
Danielle, is there any other data series that you're looking at that is also, you know, worth considering or worrying to you, other than, you know, job losses and GDP revisions?
So I do find it to be very concerning that investment grade and high yield public bond spreads remain as low as they do. They're certainly not reflecting the reality of what's happening in the bankruptcy cycle, which is accelerating. Mm-hmm. And so I do worry about certain parallels with June of 2007, when the spreads got so low, which was starting to dispute with the macroeconomic data, that there was an accident waiting to happen in the credit markets. And we already know that there's an accident that has happened in the private credit markets. But my concern is with this extra layer of macroeconomic weakness that we now start to see it bleed into the public credit markets. And remember, credit leads stocks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, exactly in that idea of the private credit markets, Danielle, there's something like $9 to $10 billion of debt that comes to maturity this year. Mm-hmm. That doesn't include new debt that needs to be issued. What do you think the appetite is for US debt at these levels, never mind that rates, like yields, are already rising?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because there's also a bunch of commercial real estate that has to be refinanced this year. I mean, you can name the asset class. There's all kinds of refinancing activity that has to occur this year. And there may be attractiveness for some investors with higher yields. There may be concern going into the midterms, however, that if there is no stimulus check that precedes the midterms, and there's even a possibility of a blue wave when the midterms do arrive, that we have set ourselves on a path to having a permanent state of post-COVID type of fiscal stimulus in the United States by the time the 2028 elections roll around, and therefore should anticipate changing the inflation narrative completely to it's going to be higher. Bond yields are going to be higher for a long time. Then you start to talk about things like the dollar and the safety of the treasury. That's why it's so important to keep politics carefully in the discussion, because we're now having, starting this Saturday, American college students graduate. This is going to be the third year in a row where an inordinate amount of them are coming out without jobs. Mm-hmm. So, and they vote, and they're all voters. 52.5% of US voters are millennials or Gen Zers, and they're all going to vote, especially if they're angry. And guess what? Their parents might vote too, if their kids have just moved back home with them after an expensive four-year degree. So the real risk is that the anger that manifests at the polls ends up permanently shifting upwards inflation, such that we're talking about a completely different treasury market here.
So what kind of tools or ideas have you seen thrown around that can manage that problem, if there is any that exists? Do you think it's possible that we see some type of a debt jubilee, a CBDC, something, you know, very outside that 10 years ago we wouldn't be speaking about, that is a possibility of being implemented within the next 5 years, let's say?
Well, one would certainly hope not, because that would really change the country. And at that point, you're probably no longer have reserve currency status either, by the way. So the implications are profound, but I prefer not to think about them. I talk to so many graduating college seniors, and my steady advice is look where AI is never going to be able to be. And if you've got a great business degree and a great business mind, and you just heard your mom complain about what she had to pay the electrician, start an electricity business, you know, redefine yourself, mm-hmm. AI proof yourself. And that is actually something that the fiscal authorities could play a hand in doing if in 1978, they hadn't handed that off to the Fed with its mm-hmm. second employment mandate, where it doesn't belong. I think taking the employment mandate away from the Fed would be such a beneficial step towards having a better balance between fiscal and monetary policy, because then you would actually have to make Congress work in times of financial distress and recession. And instead of just throwing money at people, try and thinking of how to reform education in America, how to provide a different pathway for careers to be established, instead of just writing a check and saying, heck, the Fed's going to monetize it, so who cares?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if you're thinking about trying to AI-proof, let's say, yourself or your job, where are you thinking about the, let's say, the best or worst opportunities for investors and or, you know, the average person to protect themselves from possible market crunches, liquidity squeezes, things like that?
Well, yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, in this kind of an environment, if we're talking about a second or third wave of layoffs, when there are not as many new entrants coming into the workforce as we have historically had, with 11,500 or so Americans retiring every day, you have to stop and say to yourself, the structure of passive investing could be at risk, because every 2 weeks, 401k contributions naturally levitate the market, and that money constantly flows in unless the aggregate pool of money itself starts to shrink. And so as an investor, I think you have to bear in mind how long in the tooth the passive structure is, how at threat it is, what your investment horizon is, and whether or not you feel that you should be hedged to the extent you feel you should be hedged. That's kind of where I think we are today.
Danielle, what's one under the radar, let's say, trend or data series from your QI research work that listeners should start following closely?
So in this environment, and this is something that I've mentioned for years, but I haven't mentioned in a very long time, but if you're not following the MOVE Index, I certainly think that that's critical. Everybody always follows the VIX. Think of the MOVE as being the fixed income sister of the VIX, because again, it's, you know, the cart does not lead the horse. Stocks do not lead credit. Credit leads stocks. So I would pay very close attention to the MOVE Index, which is technically treasury market volatility, but once it crosses a certain threshold, it really does start to raise a red flag about bleeding into the credit markets. So I would definitely, if you've not already bookmarked the MOVE Index, I would bookmark it as one of your tabs.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you'd like to leave our listeners to think about before we wrap up here, Danielle?
Just think hard going into the midterms. Elect people who actually can articulate policy and not just attack the other side. Elect people who have solutions, as opposed to, because we can't go on as a country as we're just voting against this person or voting against that person. Because the last time we went through a long period like that, Abraham Lincoln was elected. So we need to think long and hard about finding new leadership that can articulate true policy and not just say, vote against that person because you don't like them. Mm-hmm. Because we accomplish nothing as a country, and there are very real economic ramifications that are involved going into these midterm elections and the 2028 presidential elections, given how divided this country remains.
I think that's a, unfortunately, that's a bigger ask than it might have otherwise been in history, let's say, because it does seem like popularity politics is the best way to be elected and to garner that attention nowadays.
It's social media, it's all those things, but you know what? If there's a device out there like social media that can create one movement, maybe it can create another.
Yeah. Of course, for listeners that want to read any more of your work, X at DMartinoBooth, QIresearch.com, and of course, DMartinoBooth.substack.com. Danielle, thanks so much for your time today.
And thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.